Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a U.S. call for calm between Israelis and Palestinians. Yemeni blacks devastated by poverty and war. Drivers beware, especially younger ones.
We're talking about improving legislation and enforcing it, particularly on the key risk factors such as speed, drinking and driving, the use of motorcycle helmets, seatbelts, and child restraints.
A musical twist for U.S. healthcare. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling for restraint as he prepares to meet separately this week with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas about the latest violence. At least 8 Israelis and 41 Palestinians have died in more than 2 weeks of deadly unrest. The bloodshed was sparked by rumors that swept through the Palestinian areas that Israel was planning to take over an East Jerusalem holy site sacred to Muslims and Jews. Israel has repeatedly denied any such claims. Regional analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver told International Edition's Victor Beatty the long-running conflict is being overtaken by other regional security issues.
On both sides, there was hope that someday they would eventually get a compromise that each side could live with. And I think the world has just pretty much forgotten this. But I think it's a failure of leadership, and it starts on the Palestinian side, of course, with Abu Mazen, who's almost 80 and wants to retire to his house in Amman, Jordan. And on the Israeli side, the feeling that they're isolated after losing out on the Iran deal. Neither side is really interested right now in compromising.
Secretary of State John Kerry is to meet both Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Abbas in separate meetings. What might those conversations entail, in your view?
I don't think John Kerry is going to get far. He went many, many times, as you remember, over the last few years, trying to negotiate between the two. But the irony is that doesn't work. If you really think about it, the only times that this has worked, whether it was the Rhodes Agreement in 1949 or it was the Oslo I and Oslo II agreements, when the two sides really want to do this and they go out and they do it by themselves. Oslo was remarkable because they went to Norway and they held secret agreements on what they were going to do. I think it's nice that John Kerry is going there, but I think he actually can accomplish very little. I mean, the real issue in the Middle East today, of course, is not the Arab-Israeli conflict anymore. The real issue has to do with ISIS, it has to do with al-Nusra, it has to do with al-Qaeda, it has to do with Iran, and so this has now been kind of shoved to the side. That's the reality, and with Russia going into Syria, that's just further accelerated the trend that this is kind of an irrelevant issue, something we don't need to worry about right now.
Well, the top U.S. general, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine General Joseph Dunford, happens to be in Tel Aviv. Apparently, there are reports that Israel and the U.S. are bolstering their security ties and say those ties are back on track despite dispute over the Iran nuclear deal.
That's very good. It moves in a different direction, but I think it's important because Israel has been the biggest ally for the United States, certainly militarily. In the Middle East, there's almost $1 billion worth of American military equipment there for future conflicts. Bibi Netanyahu made up his mind that he definitely was going to try to improve what had become very poor relations between Israel and the United States, and I think the Americans did the same. But Netanyahu did something else that didn't get a lot of attention, which is he's also seriously improving his relations with Russia, which is the same thing that Saudi Arabia is doing and that Egypt is doing. In fact, they're going to go from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and elsewhere to a conference in Moscow later this year, and Netanyahu went off to Moscow to have a discussion with Putin. So I think that's something also we need to pay attention to, because it means, well, the Americans are busy with this semi-withdrawal and we're not going to get involved in any more fighting. The Russians are going in, well, maybe with not too much enthusiasm, but to show that they're a reliable ally, they're not going to withdraw from the conflicts in the Middle East.
University of Denver Middle East expert Jonathan Edelman talking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. We turn now to what the Twitter world is saying about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Here's International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
G, is there any word from the involved parties?
Yes, there is. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in particular, has been pretty active on Twitter. His handle is @IsraeliPM. The account tweeted a video of Netanyahu meeting with General Dunford Monday. Its pinned tweet, which means that's the first tweet that shows up on the Twitter page, is also about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. The pinned tweet is a clip of Netanyahu at a press conference held inside the Israeli Foreign Ministry. In the clip, he denied the rumor of his government executing innocent Palestinians. The Israeli Foreign Ministry is also on Twitter, @IsraelMFA.
And what about General Dunford? What is he saying? What did he tweet about the visit?
Surprisingly, nothing. His last tweet is from Saturday and is about the Tennessee shooting. He is on Twitter, however, @GeneralDunford. That's GENDUNFORD.
What's being said all about this from the Palestinian side?
Well, silence from that side as well, at least on Twitter. There are no tweets from its UN missions account as of Monday. The official Twitter account of the Palestinian mission to the United Nations is @Palestine_UN.
So can we conclude that it's a rather quiet day on Twitter regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Absolutely. And that's mainly because it's been going on for a while, although the tensions are especially high right now. But on a brighter note, civilians in the region also seem to be doing their part in trying to ease the tension between different races. The New York-based online publisher Vocative tweeted, "A hummus restaurant in Israel is offering diners 50% off if Jews and Arabs sit together." Ray?
Well, a bit of food diplomacy going on there. Thank you, G. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account @VOA_IE. And you can also follow her on her own account @GAbbyLee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A top UN official says the Yemeni government is agreeing to meet at the end of the month in Geneva for talks with Houthi rebels aimed at implementing a UN resolution that would end months of heavy fighting. The government's agreement to participate came after Iran-backed Shiite Houthi leaders formally committed last week to implementing a key Security Council resolution calling on rebels to withdraw from Yemeni cities seized in the past year. Similar UN-sponsored talks collapsed in June when the Iran-backed Houthis rejected calls for the unconditional withdrawal from all cities. In a humanitarian crisis so overwhelming, aid groups call it catastrophic, there is a group of Yemeni people who often suffer the most. After more than 6 months of bombings, aid workers say Yemeni blacks have become invisible victims of a war in which they have no side. VOA's Heather Murdoch has details.
Among the poorest of the poor in Yemen are Yemeni blacks, set aside from society by what lingers of an ancient, now defunct, caste system. Majid al-Jamal is a 35-year-old sheikh and local leader in this community in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. He says recent airstrikes that have hit his community did not fall anywhere near a military installation, and his people have no political affiliations at all. Mostly, they are street cleaners, beggars, or have no jobs at all. Traditionally known as the Akdam, which translates to the servants, humanitarian workers in recent years have called the group the Muhammashin, or the marginalized ones. Their communities, according to the United Nations Children's Agency, are among those hardest hit by Saudi airstrikes and the ongoing civil war. Talal Saad is a street cleaner who makes about $100 a month. He recalls his losses from a recent airstrike. He lost his father, mother, brother, and several cousins. The survivors, he says, remain scattered and homeless, isolated from the larger Yemeni society by discrimination. Another street cleaner, Abdullah Mohammed, says he not only lost his daughter in a recent strike, he also lost his ability to house the rest of his children. Unlike many other Yemeni families retreating to villages to avoid the airstrikes and battles in the cities, Mohammed says he has no place else to go. He has no choice but to share his brother's three small rooms, now housing at least 17 people, with no water or electricity. Muhammashin families often live in a state of permanent semi-homelessness, settling on government lands in makeshift homes made of found material like blankets and tires. When an airstrike hits them, they have nowhere to run and no way to recover. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. politics could become even more interesting should the current vice president decide to make a bid for the White House in 2016. Joe Biden has not said one way or the other if he plans to run for his party's nomination, a race currently dominated by Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But he's expected to announce his intentions within the next few days. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone talked with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about Mr. Biden's potential candidacy.
His shadow kind of looms over the race at the moment. Some would suggest maybe a little less after that debate, because Hillary Clinton did quite well, and to a lot of the experts, it seemed as though she sort of reclaimed a safe position as front runner, even though Bernie Sanders also continues to do well. Both Clinton and Sanders got a slight bump in the polls after this latest debate, but to some people's idea, it presented less of an opportunity for the vice president to get in. That being said, there's quite a bit of rumblings and speculation early this week that the vice president is gearing up for a run. But even the White House said Monday it's still not clear when the vice president is going to announce whatever his decision is.
What is that doing to the Democratic race?
Well, it does kind of freeze things to a degree. And there's even been a back and forth now between the Clinton campaign and some of the Biden supporters have accused the Clinton campaign of trying to bully him into a decision because they don't want to wait around forever to find out what he's going to do. So the longer this goes on, there would be some tensions there potentially. And again, you know, who are the constituencies that Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden are trying to appeal to? Quite similar, really. There's not a lot of difference on policy there. And some people are wondering, Biden may be wanting to get in as a sort of fallback if Clinton continues to have problems down the road, if the Benghazi investigation heats up, the email controversy and so forth. But the other thing about Joe Biden we have to say is he has made two tries for the presidency. They were 20 years apart, but he's long wanted to be president, and it's clear that this would be his last opportunity to at least try. And you throw in the mix, of course, the tragedy involving his son, Beau, a wish by his dying son that he run one more time. So there's a lot there to sort out for Vice President Biden, but we've seen him on some of these talk shows when he's been asked, and he's clearly been conflicted about whether or not to go.
It's perhaps a good strategy for him, if he in fact is deciding to run, to kind of stay out of the fray for a while and perhaps just kind of jump in late and say, here I am.
He could. And of course, one of the things that makes that complicated later on, late in October, more into November, you have to start registering in various primary states your campaign. And it gets a little tougher if you're not officially on the books, so to speak. So in the old days, and I'm talking way back, decades, last century, people would wait. And it was the era of the dark horse candidates and going to a convention and trying to sort it out there. In the modern era where the primaries are held early, delegates are selected based on the results of those primaries and caucuses, it's much harder to wait and swoop in at the last minute. I'm sure he's heard from plenty of Democrats saying, if you are going to do it, we need a decision sooner rather than later. And I think his supporters and this whole draft Biden movement has been calculated to try to put a little gentle pressure on him to decide.
That's VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone talking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Children are paying a high price for inequality in the world. That's the conclusion of a new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. OECD spokesperson and co-author of the report, Carrie Exton, discussed the findings with International Edition's Susan Yockey.
So there are a number of different elements covered in the report, but one of the things that we focused on for the first time this year was well-being among children. And there are some quite remarkable results. Even within OECD countries, and we're talking about 34 of the wealthiest countries in the world, we find that child poverty, for example, 1 in 7 children are living in income poverty. 1 in 10 children in OECD households are living in homes where no one works. So even among the most affluent countries, we're seeing high levels of children not getting a good start in life.
Other than the obvious reason of money, how do advantage and disadvantaged children differ in their lives?
So this was actually one of the surprising results, because obviously you would expect that among more disadvantaged groups, the material living conditions are worse, so the housing conditions might be worse, the levels of poverty might be worse. One of the surprising things in the report, though, was just how far these disadvantages spread into other elements of well-being. So if we look at, for example, some of the child health outcomes, among children from the most affluent families, only 11% of children report being in poor health. When we look at the poorer families, that rises up to 18% of children. Similarly, we have much higher rates of obesity among less affluent families. And we also see that relationships, both with peers and parents, tend to be worse among the less affluent children.
And you're talking about things that don't change. This could affect their entire lives.
This indeed is one of the reasons why it's so worrying, because we're seeing this transmission over the generations of disadvantage, and it's really something that we need to break that cycle.
Well, how do we go about doing that?
I think one of the important things about this report is that it's telling us when we think about children in disadvantage, we need to think beyond just the material conditions in which they're living. So children living in households with lower income, the parents might need a lot of support in a lot of different areas of their lives.
What about volunteering and that sort of thing, something that an average person could do?
Volunteering is another feature in this report. It's the first time that we've tried to collect comparative data across a wide variety of different countries on volunteering. And indeed, it's absolutely one of the findings that we report is that volunteering essentially offers win-wins for well-being. So we see that volunteering has advantages for communities, but it also actually is beneficial to the volunteers themselves. They tend to have higher well-being than non-volunteers.
So this report is really a signpost for folks to know that this needs to change.
Yes. I mean, one of the sort of unique features of this report is the variety of dimensions of life that we cover. We're really going much beyond GDP to try and understand ways in which life could get better for ordinary people.
And the name of the report, so folks can go online and find out about it?
It's called How's Life 2015.
Carrie Exton of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Still to come, a musical look at American healthcare. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Researchers in New York and Greenland are trying to find out why a huge glacier has begun retreating at an unprecedented pace over the last 15 years, and they've enlisted a group of seals to help. The ringed seals are able to go where boats cannot, in and around the Jakobsen Glacier in Greenland's Ilulissat Ice Fjord. David Holland is a professor of mathematics at New York University. He says the seals can go as deep as 500 meters.
They transition from the surface to the deep, warm waters. And that's what's really important to see that.
The seals are outfitted with devices that measure the depth, temperature, and salinity of water.
If the water is warm, the glaciers retreat. But as they retreat, they calve ice and sea level rises.
Holland says if parts of Greenland and Antarctica were to retreat, sea levels could go up by a meter within a century and have a huge impact on coastal cities, including New York. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. Road traffic deaths around the world continue to take a high toll. The World Health Organization says more than 1.25 million people die each year from accidents, and that they are largely preventable. The WHO is out with a new global status report. Lisa Schlein reports on the numbers and what they mean for drivers and road safety.
The report, which is based on data collected from 180 countries, shows the number of annual deaths from road traffic crashes is stabilizing. It considers this good news since this is occurring while the number of motor vehicles is increasing rapidly and populations are growing worldwide. But in a particularly sobering note, the data also show that road crashes are the number one cause of death among young people between the ages of 15 and 29. The World Health Organization report also finds a big gap in terms of road safety and deaths between poor and rich countries. It says 90% of road traffic deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries, though they have just 54% of the world's vehicles. The head of the WHO Department of Noncommunicable Diseases, Etienne Krug, says the highest rate of traffic deaths is in Africa, followed by the Middle East.
Africa has only 2% of the world's vehicles, but has the highest death rate on the road. Some countries, such as Sweden, United Kingdom, the Netherlands, etc., have managed to decrease their road deaths rate by over 80% in the last decades by implementing a set of well-known measures. We're talking about improving legislation and enforcing it, particularly on the key risk factors such as speed, drinking and driving, the use of motorcycle helmets, seatbelts, and child restraints.
Indeed, Krug says in the last 3 years, 17 countries have made progress by implementing road safety laws. He says rapid response after the crash also is important in saving lives. He says studies show half of deaths from injuries could be avoided if victims receive good trauma care after the crash. The report shows cyclists and pedestrians make up 26% of all road traffic deaths, with this figure reaching 33% in Africa. The report also finds some vehicles sold in 80% of all countries fail to meet basic safety standards. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. healthcare system features many high-tech medical solutions and medications, but that can leave less room for other priorities, such as preventive medicine and patient education. Two doctors decided to discuss the problem by giving listeners an easier pill to swallow, a musical comedy known as Damaged Care. Shelley Schlender reports from the western city of Boulder, Colorado.
Health care business ain't fair business. We gain when care's denied.
These are medical doctors singing a skit they wrote to highlight problems in America's healthcare. They call their musical Damaged Care.
Take two aspirins, call me in the morning. The less we do now, the more we make. Now you gotta outdate.
It began nearly five decades ago when Greg Lagana and Barry Levy were students at New York's Cornell Medical College. Lagana says it combined his love of acting with Levy's writing talent.
We started writing these one-act musical plays about life in medical school. The songs were all parodies of Broadway show tunes.
Levy directed, Lagana acted and sang, and they recruited other medical students to sing in a boisterous choir that lampooned both students and professors. After graduating, Lagana ran emergency rooms and urgent care centers. Levy specialized in public health and worked to improve health care overseas, including Kenya. He says their experiences heightened their frustrations about how modern medicine tends to shortchange preventative care and patient education.
And so there's so many other things, starting with diet and social support in our families and our communities, that have much more greater impact on our health than necessarily our disease care system.
So one day, close to the 25th anniversary of their medical school graduation, He called Lugano with a wacky idea.
He calls me up in 1994, and he goes, so we both turned 50 this year. We have 100 years of experience between the two of us. Nobody's written a musical comedy about healthcare. We should do that. And I said, okay, what are we going to do? And he says, we're going to take a course on writing for the musical theater together, which we did.
They created a new series of medical parodies, this time poking fun not at medical school, but at healthcare problems, such as the overuse of antibiotics.
Another outbreak! Another outbreak of a superbug!
Another outbreak of superbugs. An epidemic, come on, some hugs. Another failure of wonder drugs. Another outbreak of a superbug.
The singing doctors have shared the message many times since then, including at a recent scientific conference in Colorado. While most of the presenters at the Gold Lab Symposium discussed medical technologies and medical science, the symposium's founder, Larry Gold, says that to use emerging medical technologies wisely, sometimes our conscience needs a tickle, like from the Damaged Care team.
They're each real doctors, and they care about patients and medicine, and they're hilarious.
If we want to shape the change, let's go and see what people need and listen to our inner voice, and then as leaders take the lead.
Damaged Care has performed in over 30 states, including at hospitals and medical conferences. Its creators hope their message will reverse some of the social injustice in modern healthcare. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Boulder, Colorado.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a ceremony attended by U.S. Ambassador Eunice Reddick and Deputy Minister Kafa Rekiatu Christel-Jaku, the governments of the United States and Niger officially signed the Security Governance Initiative Joint Country Action Plan on October 9th. The Security Governance Initiative, or SGI, represents a comprehensive approach to improving security sector governance and was launched last year with six partner countries, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Tunisia. SGI will focus on civilian and military security institutions and the ministerial functions that provide state oversight of the security sector. SGI programs will differ in each country, reflecting specific partner country challenges, goals, and objectives. The SGI approach is based on partnership and joint analysis of the opportunities and challenges governments face and entails whole-of-government strategies to achieve catalytic and systematic reform in specific areas of focus related to the functioning of civilian and military institutions. Through the SGI, Nigerian and U.S. experts have worked together to develop a Joint Country Action Plan, or JCAP. The JCAP is a shared document that outlines a roadmap for a successful partnership under the SGI and identifies three focus areas: developing a national security review and strategic framework, aligning existing human and material resources more efficiently to address short and long-term security needs, and external communications. SGI is a distinctive approach. Its key goals and objectives are to increase partner nation capacity to meet citizen security needs, prevent or mitigate instability and conflict and counter-terrorist activities and their enabling environments, promote democratic governance, rule of law, respect for human rights and long-term economic development, and deepen the impact of U.S. investments in countries that show leadership and political will to make reforms and policy decisions necessary to improve security sector governance. Following the signing of this important document, the governments of the United States and Niger began developing activities to support efforts in the three focus areas. SGI teams will be visiting Niger later in October and in late November to begin this engagement. Niger and other African nations in the region face new security challenges. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Niger, to help meet these challenges and to meet the security needs of the people of Niger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.